How do students feel about school with an emphasis on feel? We're talking test stress, mental health, and mindfulness. Let's bust some pencils.
This is Busted Pencils Radio, fully leaded education talk with Dr. Tim Slecker. Here's what's trending in education news.
De-stress the test, part two. In October of 1977, I was in fifth grade. My school was located less than 2 miles from my house. One day I remember talking to my friends as we got ready for class to start. I think I was trying to find that nasty person that dared steal my pencil that I had shredded with my teeth over the last 2 weeks. Our teacher wasn't in the room, but we knew she would be there. No big deal. So I went about the business of inspecting my classmates' pencils. About a minute later, the principal stepped into our classroom. The room instantly got silent. Mr. Lopez announced that our teacher, Mrs. Heasley, was out sick and that a substitute teacher was on their way. He then looked at me and said something like, "Good thing your mom lives so close. She's on her way." Yes, my mom was going to be my substitute teacher for the day. Weird? Well, not really. All through my elementary years, my mom was a regular substitute teacher in our school. I was used to it by fifth grade. Hell, my aunt was even my kindergarten teacher. However, something happened that October day in 1977 that changed me. A sudden shift in my consciousness is the best way I can explain it. My mind went from that of an unconcerned child occupied in the daily struggle of finding my pencil to a sense of dread, darkness, fear, and an image that exploded repeatedly in my mind. I kept seeing my mom driving to our school and then suddenly losing control of her car and flying off the road into a massive collision with a tree. My stomach rolled over and my ears burned and my classroom blurred as my mom's car crash imagery bombarded my mind. Tears formed and then started flowing. I ran to the nurse's office, jumped on the cot, and murmured to the nurse that my stomach hurt. I didn't dare tell her that I was trapped in the painful imaginary loop of a car crash involving my mother. That was just not an option. In the next 5 minutes, I sat on that cot and buried my head in a pillow to hide the tears, but I could not make the image go away. It just ran over and over again, looping and sucking the life from my soul. And then I heard her voice. It's my mom's. "Timmy, what's wrong? I just got here and they told me you're in the nurse's office. Are you sick?" she said. And as suddenly as the dark imagery appeared, it was gone. I looked up and it was her. It was my mom. She had made it. She wasn't in a horrible car crash. The relief was immediate, but the confusion that followed was almost intense as the looping, soul-sucking car crash imagery. Why did my normal life as a fifth grader looking for my nasty, chewed-up pencil suddenly stop? What was wrong with me? I didn't know, but I didn't dare tell anybody either. You might ask why, and the answer was easy. People would have thought I was losing my mind, that I was one of those kids. Hell no, I would never, ever let anyone know about my first encounter with uncontrollable thoughts of despair and imagery and pain and loss. That was mine to own over the next 13 years. Yeah, for 13 years, I dealt with, quote, scary thoughts, creepy and despicable images, but I never told anybody. What's the rest of the story? Well, I don't think I'm going to share that right now, but let me say this. I'm 50 and I've been living with an anxiety disorder known as obsessive compulsive disorder since that day back in 1977. My point is this. Why? Why did I hide? Why the shame? These are deep questions with complicated answers, but there's one thing that seems very apparent. If this happened to me, how many others suffered and continue to suffer in silence, and why? Why is it news when mental health professionals are in schools wasting their time and talents helping kids get over test anxiety, teaching kids mindfulness so they can relax and score better on ridiculous standardized tests that in the end are only used to dole out punishment and label schools, teachers, and children as failing? What a waste of time. What kind of twisted reality do we live in with kids with real mental health issues continue to hide in shame while their classmates are treated to the latest breakthroughs in the treatment of anxiety and depression for meaningless test score gains? Hey, I have an idea. Let's forget about the, I won't say it now, but let's forget about those kinds of tests. How about caring for kids, and why not start teaching and treating mental illness with all the resources and passion that we do trying to please the accountability masters? It's time for a change. No more stories about de-stressing for tests. Time to talk to Timmy. Time to talk to kids like me about the horrible thoughts in our heads and help us understand. It's time to help us understand that we're not alone. It's time we try something different.
Unfiltered, comprehensive, and of course, controversial. This is Busted Pencils Radio.
He is a freelance journalist and the publisher and managing editor of The Next 10 Words, an electronic arts and entertainment magazine for Minnesota and the rest of the world, and it will officially launch on July 1st. He lives in Northfield, Minnesota with his wife, Annie. They have two nearly grown daughters. He is a fanatic about music, baseball, and politics, and he is Rich Larson. Welcome to Busted Pencils.
Hey, Tim. How you doing?
Hey, I'm doing well. Considering,
well, good.
Yeah, I mean, you know, considering what we're about to talk about, and
right,
you know, so you've got the blog, The Next 10 Words. For people who want to go and check out what we're talking about, the piece that really caught my eye was "It's Not What You Think." The first 10 words .wordpress.com. That's Rich Larson. It's Not What You Think, and you kind of take us through this. It's been a few weeks now, but the death of Chris Cornell.
Yeah.
And you know, for me, I just want to say, you know, I went through the piece, and just to give people a sense, you lay out grunge, you kind of lay out the death toll of the early days of grunge, you know, this battlefield of just overdoses and deaths.
Yeah.
And then you pull up and you introduce us to Chris, and whatever it is about this, though, you kind of say, you know, he's different. I just want to, you know, quote this from directly from your piece, because you use Chris as kind of like the turning point from where grunge decided to stop killing themselves and started to move in and be an elder statesman. But then you say, but Chris Cornell died of suicide on May 17th, 2017, at the age of 52. He was a dad. He was a philanthropist. He was becoming an elder statesman of rock. He was a grown-up. Cornell was aging gracefully, even doing that thing where some guys get better looking as they get older. Much like the rest of us, the world had kicked his ass a couple of times, and he survived. Now, end quote there. But the reality, Rich, he didn't.
No, that's true. He didn't.
Why?
Well, I mean,
I know you're not a psychiatrist, and I know you don't play one on the first 10 words and stuff like that. But I mean, we'll get into
When you and I first started talking, that was one of the first things I wanted to make sure you knew. Is I know as much about depression as anyone who's ever dealt with it, but I don't have all the medical background. You know, it was really a shocking thing to see. Because he was supposed to be beyond all this now. But that's the thing with depression. It doesn't go away. It doesn't, it's not something that you can really even cure. You have to learn how to manage it and live with it. But it doesn't go away once you magically, you know, turn 30, or once you've made your $1 million and you are stable, it's always going to be kind of in the background.
Well, yeah, and that's, you know, that was, I said why, and that's, I mean, this is it. It's depression, and people who didn't know that Chris Cornell was suffering from depression, and we can put this out there as millions of people in America suffer from some form of mental illness, depression in this one, and, you know, but here it is from you know, I want to hit your post one more time at least, and because you put this out, you know, but he's gone now, and God damn it, his death is one that bothers me the most. And you're talking about all the other deaths of the grunge, you know, battlefield. And I've been thinking about this. I'm realizing that it's both a personal and a generational thing. Cornell had a long struggle with depression, as have I, as have many of you. And is that it there, because that's the part that grabbed you, because you as a person with depression went, wait a minute, I thought I was cured. I thought Chris Cornell was cured. He's not. Now what about me?
Well, You know, that's a good question. I would tell you that in the last, I don't know, 4 or 5 years, what I've come to grips with in this thing is that it doesn't go away. But I guess, you know, you look at a guy like Cornell, who was so smart, so successful, really had everything going on, and had openly talked about being depressed, and didn't really shy away from it. And that was a guy that you could use maybe as a role model.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Chris Cornell had maybe figured it out. And if Chris Cornell can figure it out with all that other stuff going on all around him, then maybe I can figure it out too. And then maybe not.
I mean, I know we see it, some people see it as a sign of weakness, Rich. But when I go to your comment section, the problem I have with some of the comments are, and boy, I'm going to take a risk by saying this, but when people make the comment that Chris Cornell, how selfish of a person was he to do that when he had everything, when he had kids, when he had this, which points to me again saying, you don't understand.
Not even close.
Because it's not that Chris Cornell didn't know that he didn't have kids and didn't have all these things. And, you know, it's like when that depression hits. And so to not understand it is to not understand that those things, people aren't running away from those things. It's so hard to get there. And it's not to say that I've wanted to be there, but that feeling of absolute desperation is not a conscious choice where you're saying my kids are my life.
No. And the thing is, you start feeling like a burden. And you start feeling like everyone around you would be better off without you. And that's when it gets really scary, because you can make that sound completely legitimate. It can feel like it's the only option. It's the best way to go. It's the only option.
Yeah, and so knowing that, right, is
right.
Is where we say, let's educate people.
Exactly.
Let's get people to first, as you said, this is not a weakness, you know, and God damn it, that stigma is still out there, and you are right, it's not a weakness. But for other people, I think, to get a sense of, you know, I wrote down some notes here, you know, what does it mean to live with a mother who suffers from bipolar depression?
Right.
What's that like? How about the kid that came in the morning after Chris Cornell, who's a massive fan and just thinks, hey, if Chris did it, this is my way. I mean, how do we talk? You know, here's an opening. And I don't think teachers and I don't think schools, and this is a criticism for me, are prepared to teach about mental illness. We still do the, well, at least we now have counselors in schools to help people get the help they need. People who need the help are the ones living with us.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Well, it absolutely does. My marriage has survived 25 years of this, but it's only because my wife is a saint and actually has a degree in psychology and sort of understands a little bit of what's going on with my brain sometimes.
Does she charge you?
I pay for it.
No, go ahead, Rich.
Well, no, but I mean, that's the thing. It's it really is. The people who need to understand this are the people who don't deal with it, for the sake of the people who do, if that makes sense. When you start feeling like you can't ask a soul for help, when you start feeling like you're the only person in the world, you know, people need to know how to react to that.
Yeah.
And to at least, you know, I don't think we should be asking anybody to be experts in the field, but at least to identify what it is they're seeing and not think, oh, he's, you know, that guy's just, he's a loser, you know?
Well, yeah, either the person who thinks that somebody going through this is a loser, or for somebody like you or Chris or me who's sitting there going through it, to have somebody come up and say, hey, you're having one of your tough days today, aren't you?
Yeah.
You know, because we don't want them to be therapists. They're not, you know. But the idea of the silence and the, you know, you walk around, and as I used to think about it when it really hit me hard my junior year in college, you know, I'd try to walk around and look like the same old guy that everybody thought they knew. But deep inside my head, there was this war, this battle going on. And I would have loved if I could have had one of my, you know, best friends look up and go, damn, dude, this sucks.
You know, just asking that question that you just put, you're having one of your bad days, aren't you? I had a visceral reaction to it just hearing it, and I'm actually feeling pretty good these days.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's that kind of reaching out and that kind of compassion can alleviate more pressure than I think most people could possibly realize.
Well, maybe that's it then, you know, just compassion. And that's what we're looking for here.
Yeah.
You know, so Rich, the blog is the first 10 words. It's going to be
right. Officially
launched July 1st. The piece.
I should just clarify that real quick.
Go for it.
The next 10 words is the site that myself and a few of my colleagues are working on. That's an electronic arts and entertainment magazine that's going to launch July 1st. Until we have that site up, we're using my personal blog, which I've named the first 10 words, as just a place to park our writing, and because, you know, writers got to write, man.
Well, so. Yeah, writers got to write. But, you know, for anybody dealing with this and wants to help us get this issue into schools, I mean, take a look at It's Not What You Think, because that's the title there. And for people who are going through this, It's Not What You Think. And if you're one of these people that can relate to Rich, can relate to me, and you know, or thinking, reach out and just tell somebody, hey man, I need some help, and let's start there. Yeah. How about that, Rich?
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Well, Rich Larson, hey, as we still like to say, though, I mean, the pencils we busted today were a little bit harder than normal, but I appreciate all the work you do and that piece right there and pushing us to this edge. So, Rich Larson, It's Not What You Think. Thanks for busting pencils with us, man.
Hey, Tim, thanks a ton for having me. This is a great podcast.
Rich will be back later in the show to tell us about the schools he feels our children deserve. My conversation makes me wonder, what would Matt Damon's mom think about adding more mental health to the curriculum?
Wait, what? You want to know what my mom would say? All right, well, just ask her.
But for me, the question is, what is the appropriate role for schools in dealing with the whole emotional side of education and human behavior in life in school?
Mm-hmm.
And when you think about younger kids, you can't separate that out. That comes to school. The emotional life, the social life of a young child comes to school. A lot of my career, the earlier books and articles I wrote, they had to do with how do you talk to children about difficult subjects. For example, the Persian Gulf War, 9/11. Because what would happen is young children would come into a classroom and they would be talking about these things that were happening in the world around, that were on the news on the night before, their parents were talking about. And it would make, in many cases, many teachers very uncomfortable because they hadn't learned anything in their teacher prep programs about how to deal with these kinds of issues. And often my graduate students would say, the teachers would say to the things to children like, don't talk about that here.
Mm-hmm.
You can talk to your parents about that. And the kind of work that I was doing with teachers was really to bring those issues that kids brought to school into the classroom and to be able to talk openly with kids about what was happening in their lives and how they were feeling about what was happening in their lives. And my image of education is that model of integrated whole human beings coming to school and having their whole selves and the context they come from be welcomed in school should continue all the way through school.
You know, we're doing a good job of advocating for mental health services for those that need it. However, we're not nearly delivering the way we should. But at least we're advocating. But I was also thinking about going, aren't we also missing an education part for, quote, everybody about mental health issues, issues of depression, issues of anxiety, dealing with those things? Because everybody's got somebody in their family right now who has some mental illness issue that's going on. And the idea, though, and when we look at somebody like Chris Cornell, from what I'm reading, is that this is somebody who suffers in silence. And that's the part where I think public schools are great at advocating for treatment for those who need treatment. But I was thinking that this question, should public schools be doing more about just educating about mental illness, about what it's like to have depression, what it's like to live with a sibling who's going through this, or a parent or a godparent? I mean, is there a role in the public schools to continue this discussion beyond just advocating for treatment for those who need it?
I hear what you're saying. You're thinking about educating about mental health issues. And I think there is a place for that. And I also think when children come to school, they have mental health issues that they are bringing into the classroom and that need to be welcomed and worked with by teachers at every level. I'll give you an example. I observed in a kindergarten class in the Boston Public Schools, and I wasn't there on this day, the teacher told me, but a little boy named Carlos, they had a group meeting every morning. They would sit in a circle and they would have a conversation. And this little boy one morning, Carlos, raised his hand on a Monday morning and said, "My parents were fighting over the weekend and it was scary." This is the moment when the teacher decides, what do I do? And this teacher did what I consider a brilliant thing. She said, she let Carlos talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
Then she met with her student teacher after meeting, and she said, probably every one of these kids has seen their parents fighting, right? And they all have feelings about it. And she remembered her own parents fighting and how she felt. She developed the whole rest of the curriculum that day and for days after. At the art table, they were painting feelings. What do I feel like when I feel scared?
Mm-hmm.
What does anger look like? They had role plays where they were playing out what do you do when you hear your parents fight. They were doing it in block building and in every area of the class. They had a curriculum activity going on around this question of how do we feel when we see other people fighting. And what I'm saying to you is that this little boy, Carlos, if he hadn't known that he could bring this up in school...
Mm-hmm.
They also made a huge book, by the way, and every kid wrote in it. It was out there for everyone to see, including all the parents. It was quite amazing to take this approach. This is a Boston public school. And this little boy might have held his fear and anxiety about his parents fighting inside. If he went to a school today, there would be no room to be talking about this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's all test-based. There's no group conversations. There's no bringing in your emotional life. So on a daily basis, do not have the opportunity to talk in a trusting, free way about how you feel in a safe and loving environment that over time you learn to hide it.
That's where I'm going with this, is wondering, we talk about mental health issues and awareness, but yet even while we're advocating for the treatment, we're still... if we do get the treatment, we're still sending the kids to get the treatment out of the classroom to come back into the classroom.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just thinking about the kids that sit there who are, whether, as you just pointed out, a mother and father fighting, and or a child who themselves may be on the verge, or let's even imagine a 17-year-old, 2 weeks ago, who's a follower of Chris Cornell and just comes mm-hmm. into school and has questions.
Yeah.
Like you said, how do we, I don't know that we're prepared to answer those questions, but I think we better be prepared.
Yeah.
And that's my point, is I get worried about this because we would... Yeah, well, go see the counselor. And maybe this is the point to say, no, actually, let's talk about these issues. We need to know more. So there's an education about, whether we call it mental illness or mental health, but just
Both. Mental health. I mean, but there's an education about our own inner lives, our own feelings, our fear, our anxiety, our anger. We have to allow these parts of ourselves to have a place in the curriculum. One of the teachers, an early childhood teacher who went through our Peaceable Schools program, did this whole fantastic curriculum on anger. When I went to visit her, the kids did this whole thing. They'd put on the angry suit and they'd act out what it feels like to be angry, and they made a book about it. And, you know, what does your body feel like when you're angry? What do you do when you're angry? And this sort of exploration of our inner lives is something that generally is not considered to be part of education, but it needs to be.
Yeah, I was just thinking, I mean, I just imagined that, you know, you were talking about the angry suit, and, you know, again, we reduce it down to smaller kids, but just moving that up into like a restorative circle in the high school and allowing 15-year-olds to talk about the realities of living with, you know, anxiety, depression, living with a parent who's going with that, and talking about these issues so that we have, you know, mental health education.
Right. That's the most the most appropriate role for schools, I feel, is exactly that, is to open the door for children to be able to talk about these issues, whatever way they're manifesting in their lives. And also, one interesting side of this is that when, I'm sure you know this if you've done therapy or self-reflecting work, that when you can talk about these things with others, first of all, you find out almost everyone has similar feelings. And also, when you do talk about these issues, they do de-escalate within you. That is to say, you feel less anxious and often less depressed if you understand you're not weird. There's nothing wrong with you.
I feel weird a lot sometimes.
Well, I mean, some people are weird. Yeah. You know, maybe.
Well,
you're the better one to say that. But no, you know, I'm not diminishing the importance of real conditions of mental illness.
Right.
But there is a big spectrum on which we all feel depressed sometimes. We all feel anxious sometimes. And some people are feeling those ways to an extreme so that they feel like they can't function. And there's a huge continuum. And with a lot of young people, we can work right in schools with these things.
Well, I know this. On Busted Pencils, when we talk to Matt Damon's mom, my anxiety level definitely drops.
Oh, I love to hear that.
This is Matt Damon on Busted Pencils Radio. Please stop bothering me and just ask my mom already.
Rich Larson is back to take on that famous Alfie Cohn question. What are the schools our children deserve?
Our children deserve to go to schools in the greatest possible position there is. I mean, I will quote Aaron Sorkin when he says, schools should be palaces. The competition for teaching jobs should be as strong as it is to be, you know, the best lawyers, the best accountants, the best whatever. There's really a problem with a society that values, and I say this as a baseball fan, a third baseman far more than it values a teacher. Our kids deserve to be learning in the best possible environment with the best possible people.
Unfiltered, comprehensive, and of course, controversial. This is Busted Pencils Radio.
Time for our new feature, Cohn's Zone. Joining us now, author, scholar, speaker extraordinaire, Alfie Cohn. Alfie, we are focused on mental health in this episode. In one of your previous Huffington Post essays, Cheerful to a Fault, you have a very interesting take on this. You say we need to have kids be concerned about whether other people are happy. What do you mean by that?
Well, too often we're focused in schools only on kids' academic achievement. And the first check on that limitation is to say that we are interested in their intellectual development, which is much broader than achievement, especially if achievement is defined just in terms of standardized test scores. In fact, we could talk for some time just about the difference between schools that are focused in promoting kids' intellectual growth and those that are merely focused on their achievement academically.
Right.
Then the next step is to say, well, maybe there's more to it than that. Maybe we want kids to be happy people and not merely people who have certain cognitive proficiencies. And lots of parents will say that. I just want my kids to be happy. Although in practice, they often aren't satisfied with kids who come home happy if they haven't performed well at various tasks at school or at sports. But I want to add yet another check to this, which is that we want kids who are concerned about the happiness and well-being of others, who are not merely content in their own right, which is purely self-focused. And I think most of us as parents and educators on reflection would like some combination. I mean, we don't want kids who are devoted selflessly to the well-being of others to the point that they're miserable.
Right.
But I think in our society, there's probably more danger of the reverse, which is that this makes me happy is the beginning and end of the discussion without enough attention to the impact of our actions on the people around us.
So, I mean, you're getting at the idea, and I've seen you talk about this as being one of the goals of education. What if we simply said empathy? Or is that where you're headed with this, this being a powerful goal for education?
Well,
or is that oversimplifying?
It's getting us on one track that I think is useful.
Mm-hmm.
First, I'll make a sort of arcane academic distinction, which is between empathy and perspective taking.
Okay.
And empathy is where I feel your pain.
Okay.
And perspective taking is where I imagine your pain or happiness or how the world looks to you. A lot of people sort of sloppily use the term empathy to refer to what is really better referred to as perspective taking.
Okay.
But what we want is for kids to both understand and share in the experiences of others, the viewpoints as well as the affective or emotional experience of others. We also want kids with their heads to be ethical. Sometimes we do the right thing because of our understanding that it is the right thing, even if we don't empathize or even do perspective taking. Those are all different paths that lead to, I think, a moral life. And I think that clearly plays a role when you ask teachers as well as parents what they hope their kids will be like in the long run. People usually make some reference to not only turning out to be good learners, but also good people. And these are components, arguably, of what it means to be a good person.
What about the issue of the other range of emotions, anger, sadness, appropriate?
Yes, depending on how much and in what context and what caused it and how constructive. I don't regard anger or sadness or guilt as being like dandruff, you know, something you just want to get rid of because they're unpleasant.
Right.
I think my value judgment is that to experience the full dimensions of a human life is to experience that. And there are some things around us that ought to make us angry or sad. I'm a little worried by people who seem always on an even keel and always whistling, even which means they're often not outraged by outrageous things.
Right. There's enough if you look around. They say if you open your eyes and you're not, what's the bumper sticker? If you're not angry, you're not paying attention.
Yes, that's right. That's right. But we don't want people who are angry all the time. It's not constructive. It's not healthy. It's usually not a good sign. Just as we don't want people to be just mindlessly cheerful. We don't want mindlessness at all, I guess is what I'm saying. And there's a difference, too, between being sad or feeling guilty in a way that just drives us ever further into ourselves, or into, I guess, an unconstructive life of trying to pull away and just need to make ourselves feel better. And on the other hand, feeling these things in a way that lead us to try to take constructive action to rectify whatever caused those unpleasant sensations.
So so we're talking about the range of human emotions as being part of schooling, and the fact that we try to avoid them could itself be problematic. Or
I've seen this sign up in three different schools around the country in the classroom. It says, only positive attitudes permitted beyond this point. And I thought...
Did you walk out?
I thought, I walked in because I was curious to see who this person was who put up that sign, because I think what that sign really should have said is, my mental health is so precarious, you have to pretend you're happy. when kids feel anger and sadness and so on, and to tell them that that's not welcome because they have to have positive attitudes, it doesn't make those negative feelings go away. It just kicks them under the rug where the people will trip over them, so to speak.
Right.
And it also often says, I don't want to hear your objection or your whining about what I'm doing as the teacher, which is a way of saying it's not convenient for me to question the reasonableness of what I'm doing. And that's really not a classroom that's based on the well-being of the students at all, but merely the convenience of the teacher.
Well, that's it. And so when we get at the well-being of the students, that's what we're talking about here. So happiness as a primary goal, the range of emotions as a primary goal. If we're finding classrooms that can bring that out in students in a healthy way, I would imagine that Alfie Cohn would be in support of that.
Yes, that's right. And the good news is that there are certain practices in classrooms and schools that can simultaneously help kids feel happier, help them become more moral people, and contribute to their intellectual development. I mean, if, for example, we have class meetings where kids come together to make decisions and solve problems. If we have kids spending a lot of their day in pairs and small groups doing cooperative learning, research shows that when these things are done well, they contribute to intellectual development and to kids' social moral development.
For more on Alfie, you can go to his website, alfiecohn.org. We also have links on the Busted Pencils site. Really looking forward to having Alfie on the show on a regular basis. Like what you hear? Subscribe and write us a review in iTunes and Google Play. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and visit us at BustedPencils.com. Howard Zinn was a legendary author, historian, and activist. Each episode, we pay tribute to him with our moment of Zinn.
Pessimism becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. It reproduces itself by crippling our willingness to act.
My thanks to Alfie Cohn, Matt Damon's mom, Rich Larson, and you, the Busted Pencils listener. I'm Dr. Tim Slecker. Keep busting pencils.
Log on to BustedPencils.com for the latest trending news, blogs, past shows, and more. Subscribe to our podcast in iTunes and Google Play. And get daily updates by following us on Facebook and Twitter at Busted Pencils. This is Fully Leaded Education Talk. Busted Pencils Radio.